Hello and welcome to the Journal of Democracy podcast. I'm Brent Kalmer, managing editor of the journal, and we're fortunate today to be joined by Dr. Leon Aaron, who is resident scholar and director of Russian studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He is also the author of an article entitled Putin versus Civil Society, The Long Struggle, which appears in the July 2013 edition of the Journal of Democracy. So first off, Dr. Aaron, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Your article is really a fascinating look into the nature of Russia's new protest movement, which, of course, was born in the wake of the December 2011 State Duma elections. Can you give us a brief flavor for how this kind of got kicked off and how it's grown through time?
Well, as you said, the immediate cause was a very blatant falsification of the results of the election. And much more than that. So, if you look at the slogans of the demonstrators, they're very much in line with actually what followed this summer. In particularly, as you know, it was a summer of the middle class discontent in Bulgaria, Bosnia, in Turkey and Brazil, and it is the demonstration was for, well, obviously for honest elections, but also for the equality before the law, against the corruption, against sort of this authoritarian squeeze on civil society, and generally against the state's sort of, you know, interference in the life of people, of its citizens. And I think this is very much in line with what is happening now. In fact, I would dare say that the Russian protests of winter 2011-2012 had a very long pedigree, a very strong connection to the previous civil rights, civil disobedience movements. But also, I think, tells us a great deal about what's happening now and what might happen in other societies where the middle class wants to have a say in how the country is governed.
Now, it's interesting that you point out middle class in particular, because one of the things you mentioned in the article is that parts of the protest movement have kind of been portrayed as this upper crust kind of elite set. In the words of the New York Times, quote, debonair demonstrators in mink coats and designer jeans, unquote. But your interviews, which were done from east to west throughout Russia, seem to paint a far different picture. What did you conclude about the makeup of the Russian protest movement?
Well, Brent, the first thing is these two. You know, I have to make this caveat: the study of six civil society groups that I undertook happened 6 months before the protests, and they were not necessarily the ones that I mean, there were some overlap, but they were, you know, they were very, you know, they were environmental groups, they were, you know, traffic security groups and safety groups, they were, they had all kinds of causes. And in the end, I think, although I'm almost certain that many, if not most, of those whom I interviewed actually turned out in the demonstrations in Irkutsk or St. Petersburg or Kaliningrad or Moscow, it was a little bit different. But your question can be answered very nicely, I think, by the data collected on the during the demonstration on the Sakharova Prospect on December 24th, 2011, where a very substantial and very, you know, methodologically correct polling was conducted by the most authoritative of Russian polling organizations, the Levada Center. And some of those data I cite in the article. Yes, there were definitely some from the middle class, upper middle class, I should say. But they were no more than 5 to 7% in terms of how they answered the question about the income. In Russia, actually, as in other developing societies such as China, Turkey, Brazil, income is not everything. The middle class is defined not just by income, but by their occupation and profession and education. And in that regard, as well as income, the overwhelmingly, up to 70% of the participants belong to the what could be said the Russian middle class, solid Russian middle class.
And there's something interesting about this movement, which is the profoundly moral character of it, that there seems to be a language of kind of moral decency and dignity that pervades the protest movement. Is that related to this heritage or conceived heritage within the civil rights and civil resistance movements back through time? Is it something that has been ingrained in this movement from the beginning, or has it evolved?
No, absolutely, Brent. For this article, I went back and I read a considerable amount on the civil rights and civil disobedience and the civil resistance movements from, you know, Gandhi to King to the Philippines, the People's Power, and so on and so forth, to Tiananmen Square. And the first thing that you notice is that prior to these movements developing, you know, a political agenda and crystallizing as purely political movements, they all start as a movement of what might be called, you know, moral revulsion. I mean, whether it's against racism or colonialism, racial discrimination, the bottom line, Brent, is unfairness. It's the unfair distribution of political power where either you're prevented from polling based on your race, or because you want to vote for an opposition party, or because you're a liberal, or because you're anti-regime, or on the unequal distribution of the economic wealth of the country, which is corruption. And the equality before the law is another issue. Again, it could be because of the color of your skin, but in the Russian case, it's as by the way is the case in from what I understand from the from reading about the protests in Turkey or Brazil, it could simply be because you don't have enough money and somebody pays more to the judge or has political connections, as was the case in Egypt. Or Tunisia, and therefore you shut out of the political process. So ultimately, I've come with this formula, and you know, I hope that, you know, it will be you know, refined and made even better by your readers. But my sense is that I called it the moral imperative of dignity in democratic citizenship. I think that sort of incorporates the entire gamut, the entire range of demands in sort of one definition, one phrase.
And there's also this interesting generational reality that a lot of the people who are now protesting are much younger, and it's not enough for them to realize that they're now able to afford more, or perhaps their standard of living has increased, as might have been the case in the past, and they might not have a memory of the way things were in much leaner times. Does that make people more willing to demand rights at a political level?
Absolutely. You know, this is another across the board feature from the Arab Spring to you know, the Taksim Square in Istanbul, to some Sao Paulo in Brazil, and of course the Russian protesters exhibited it. It is, first of all, it's generational. You're absolutely right. Everywhere, younger people, and by that I mean, you know, between 20 and 45, were the plurality. In other words, they were the single largest group And I think in Egypt and Turkey, the age was even lower. I mean, in other words, the leaders were probably between the age of 20 and 30, meaning the single largest age group. But there's something else here. Yes, age is important. The generation is important because it's the internet generation, and there are all kinds of interesting things associated with it. But there's something else. Just a very recent public opinion poll in Russia showed that even if people's incomes are growing, and actually they're not growing at all as much as they grew in the first 8 years of Putin from 2000 to 2008, and that presents a huge political problem for him. The Russians tell pollsters that the incomes, the growth of incomes, are not the most important thing. Well, what is? Well, healthcare, education, political participation, utilities, inflation. In other words, as I'm rattling it off to you, it sounds like a standard, Western middle class concerns. Yes, incomes are important, but the growth of incomes, even though everywhere in these societies where we saw the middle class protests, the incomes have come down considerably, and I think this was part of the one of the reasons for the protests. Even if incomes were to grow considerably, that is no longer enough to secure the loyalty, to secure the contentment of the new middle class. And that, by the way, is something that political theory, starting from de Tocqueville, tells us should happen. In other words, when you're very hungry, you could swallow corruption, you could swallow arbitrariness, just if somebody feeds you, meaning if somebody gives you a nice income so you could buy a television set and the refrigerator and then the car and then go on vacation abroad. But once that level is met, different things begin to matter to the middle class, and that makes coping with it much harder for the regimes.
And that seems to speak to the importance of the middle class participation in the protest movement in general. I'd like to get into one of the things that really stuck out as I reread your piece, and I'm just going to read this quote to you, and I'll ask for your thoughts on it. You write that, quote, "The greatest weapon of successful protest movements has been their ability to undermine the legitimacy of the regimes they oppose. They do not need to persuade the majority of the people to join their cause. Revolutions, not to mention reforms or changes of regimes, are never made by majorities," unquote. And this really stands out to me because kind of as you're thinking on a very surface level, you imagine just a vast majority of a population rising up. But what you're saying is that you really don't need a majority. You need a majority to, if I understand this correctly, stop supporting the regime. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Brent, when I was writing this, I too was struggling with the stereotype. I don't know where we get it from our books, from old movies, with the peasants with pitchforks, storming the manors and the castles. Nowhere is the case. I mean, if you ask yourself what percentage of the American population, colonists, were for independence from Britain, they were a clear minority. What percentage of the French population were the Jacobins or the sans-culottes or the Paris mob in general? What percentage of the British population during the English Revolution were the Ironsides and the enthusiasts that marched with Cromwell? And I'm not even talking about the Bolsheviks, who started with literally a few thousand. So the idea that in order to effect a revolution you need an arithmetic majority is of course historically wrong, but I think it's even more so in the 21st century because, in the 19th century or say even you know, up to Stalin's collectivization and industrialization, you know, the 30s or even the 50s of the 20th century. Essentially, the state's might was largely defined by how much coal you produce and how much steel you produce and what you make with that coal and steel and how many tanks you make and how many battleships and cannons. Well, in that case, you could sort of ignore the middle class, and the dictators did it. I mean, they you know, from Stalin to Franco to Salazar, I mean, essentially, you know, the middle class doesn't like me, well, that's too bad. I mean, I could kill them or I could ignore them. Unfortunately, for the dictators, but I think fortunate for the rest of us, it is no longer the case in the 21st century where the consensus is that for any country to sustain a prolonged, peaceful modernization and progress, you really need the self-organizing, self-sustaining, responsible, adequately informed, active civil society, the best representation of which is the middle class or the non-governmental groups and civic associations. And this, incidentally, what Putin is against, is up against. And I think eventually he, like other authoritarians before him, is going to lose this game because you cannot progress as a country, even with the very high oil prices, if you do not unleash, as it were, the middle class. And this makes these protests, either consisting entirely of the middle class or the majority of the middle class, or led by the middle class, very important. And one other thing pertaining to your question, again, the stereotype, for example, is that you know, such movements as Mahatma Gandhi's movement for independence, for the independence of India, or the civil rights movement in the U.S. were the movements of the dispossessed. And it's true that the dispossessed were present in substantial numbers. However, it was always a middle class. Those were always, like others, middle class led movements. In my article, I present some of the findings of my research to the effect that essentially the Southern Baptist movement that became the core of the civil rights movement was based in Atlanta, and Atlanta has the largest African American middle class in the United States. And of course, Martin Luther King himself, like others, was a product of or attained the status of the middle class. So you know, again, the long and the short of it for a contemporary dictator is that yes, you can ignore the middle class. Yes, you could put some of its members in jail, but in the long run, you really have to come to grips with its demands or be gone.
And it sounds like the Kremlin, for its part, understands this dynamic of a rising middle class, as can be seen in this kind of war on civil society, but perhaps does not have a real solution for that.
That is the problem. The sad reality in Russia today is that everybody understood. I was there last time in April. Everybody, I mean, including, at least on the rhetorical level, Putin and his Prime Minister Medvedev, and of course all his ministers, everybody understands that the country, the oil and gas are no longer reliable engines of even a decent income, much less progress and modernization. But in order to effect the modernization, you need deep reforms. And these reforms could be, you know, economic, but they also must be political. When you start an anti-corruption campaign, you need to unleash mass media. But you can't unleash mass media if all three national television channels are entirely under the bureaucratic control of the state. You need to give people an opportunity to throw the bums out. Well, how can you do it if there is no really, truly free political choice? And again, these are all the issues that were brought up in the demonstrations of the winter of 2011-12. So this is a vicious circle. You need reform to have progress and modernization, it's a vicious circle for a dictator like Putin. But you cannot undertake these reforms because in the end, no matter how circumspect you are, they will lead to a collapse of the regime. They always point out to Gorbachev, and it's a separate issue. I've written recently published a book about this. It's much more complex than that. But to those who occupy the Kremlin today, the Gorbachev lesson is, okay, you give them an inch, and they're gonna ask for a foot.
And this dynamic seems to apply to, you know, things that are happening on the front page. We read today that Alexei Navalny has had his mayoral bid accepted for running for the mayoralty of Moscow. And yet that seems to perhaps augur that he will receive a jail sentence that would preclude him ever serving. Is this kind of tactic that will be used?
We are, yes, the Navalny sentence is about to be announced. It will be announced tomorrow. I've always felt, unfortunately, that he'll get at least 6 years in jail on totally bogus charges. This tactic of the regime essentially it was a product of a choice. Short-term stability versus longer-term progress and development and modernization of Russia. And the regime opted for what it considered short-term stability, which, of course, I don't think is going to be sustainable even in the short term. And yes, you're right. There were several prongs to the strategy, one of which was judicial harassment and persecution. Such as in the case of Navalny. And next in line, by the way, is another leader, another most popular leader of the winter protests, and that is Sergei Udaltsov, who is under house arrest. And he's charged with an even more serious crime. He's charged with conspiring, get this, with the government of Georgia to overthrow the regime. So in his case, it's at least 10 years in jail. And there are many others throughout the country that, you know, some of them are not as well known. That's one sort of tactic. Another tactic is a turn to a deeply reactionary ideology. That occurred largely after Putin's re-election in 2012. It's nationalism parading as patriotism. It's the Russian Orthodox Church that is now being called upon to enforce mores. It is a very selective use and defense of Soviet and even Stalinist past, and in general sort of the desire to take the entire sort of area of cultural and moral, and here's these are all quotes from Putin's recent speeches, moral education into the hands of the government. And then the final tactic is the so-called laws. I mean, the since Putin came back as president, in short order, the Duma, which is the parliament, passed at least half a dozen laws that marginalize or penalize or in other ways harass non-government organizations. I mean, the list is well known. So clearly, it's a well thought out strategy to essentially assail the civil society and the middle class and the non-government organization as sort of the most politically unreliable parts of civil society. And one other thing, Brent, before we finish, the sad part, probably the saddest part of it is not even individual persecutions, much as my heart goes out to those who have been suffering. Look at what happened in Egypt after the regime collapsed. Because of Hosni Mubarak's 20-some years, actually 30 years, of systematic extirpation of civic society, or erosion, or subjugation by bribes, or essentially pushing the best and the brightest into exile, which, by the way, has been going on in Russia in an alarmingly increasing rate. When that happens, and when regime finally collapsed, they all collapse eventually. What you have is the absolute, I mean, you could choose your simile. It's either, you know, scorched earth or permafrost of the soil of civic society, which is indispensable to democracy. So in other words, in 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and you know, democratic institutions were established, they could not be sustained because there was no civil society to support them. Now, in Russia, in the past 20 years, that civil society did come to exist. I've met those people. We've read about them. They're remarkable, and it's a very mature civil society. But if Putin decides, as he seems to have decided, that he will systematically attack that civil society, marginalize it, extirpate it, just as Mubarak did, then when that regime collapses, we will. What if we see something like we're seeing in Egypt, except happening in a nuclear superpower? In other words, no compromise, zero-sum politics, hatred, inability to reason with your political opponent, absence of tolerance, absence of self-organization, except to go and smash windows and protest, but the absence of sustained ability to organize politically. How does that grab you in terms of say 2018, 2019, 2020? In a nuclear superpower in the largest country on Earth.
Well, it's a fascinating and sobering discussion. We certainly appreciate you being with us, Dr. Aaron. Again, I've been joined by Dr. Leon Aaron, who is resident scholar and director of Russian studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and he is the author of an article entitled Putin versus Civil Society, The Long Struggle, which appears in the July 2013 issue of the Journal of Democracy, and by the way, is posted at the American Enterprise Institute's website at aei.org. So please go there and read Dr. Aaron's work. And thanks again, Dr. Aaron.
Thank you, Brent.